From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Democracy Now!
With my injuries, I may not be in the Army very much longer. I'm going to be a 21-year-old freshman in college. and a war vet at that, with a Purple Heart.
As Iraqi civilians and U.S. soldiers continue to die in Iraq, we'll hear from soldiers wounded in action. But first, the 9/11 Commission reveals that secret surveillance warrants sought by the FBI have gone up 85% since President Bush took office 3 years ago. We'll look at surveillance of rap artists with hip-hop journalist Davey D.
And we'll be talking about the fact that the surveillance is nothing new. It's an offspring of the war on drugs and COINTELPRO, so we're going to be talking real deep about that.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel has sparked massive international outcry following its assassination this weekend of the new Hamas leader, Abdelaziz al-Rantisi, in Gaza. His car was hit by rockets fired from an Israeli military helicopter. The United Nations, the European Union, and several nations called the killing a clear violation of international law. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan labeled it an extrajudicial killing. Meanwhile, in Gaza, tens of thousands of Palestinians marched through the streets in a funeral procession for Rantisi. Hamas says a new leader in Gaza has been appointed, but his identity is being kept secret for security reasons. The organization has vowed a, quote, volcano of revenge against Israel for the deaths. We'll have more on this in just a moment. In Iraq, the U.S. lost 12 soldiers over the weekend, including five near the Syrian border, bringing the month's death toll to 100, marking the deadliest month for U.S. troops since the invasion began a year ago. 700 U.S. soldiers have now died in Iraq. The Knight Ridder News Agency reports the past 2 weeks have been the deadliest two-week span for U.S. troops since October 1971 during the Vietnam War. The New York Times is estimating U.S. forces have killed at least 1,000 Iraqis since the beginning of April. At least 650 Iraqis have died in Fallujah alone. Spain's new prime minister announced Sunday his country would pull its 1,400 troops out of Iraq within the next 15 days. José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero had originally said he would only pull the troops out on July 1st if there was not a new UN resolution. But after the recent Iraqi uprising, Zapatero said the move must take place as soon as possible. Spain's troops are stationed now outside Najaf, the Shiite holy city, where the U.S. has threatened to invade in order to kill cleric Muqtada Sadr. On Friday, Sadr warned that his followers would wage a general war against the U.S. if it decided to invade Najaf. Meanwhile, the London Telegraph is reporting the British commander of troops in southern Iraq has admitted that he would be powerless to prevent the overthrow of coalition forces if the Shiite majority in Basra rose up in rebellion. The Washington Post reports the U.S.-led reconstruction effort in Iraq has all but stopped due to security concerns. In addition, scores of Iraqis have quit their jobs helping the U.S. in reconstruction. One U.S. official told the Washington Post, quote, "It's a catch-22. We can't start the work that's supposed to help improve security until security improves." Meanwhile, a new book titled Plan of Attack by Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward reports President Bush asked Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to begin planning to invade Iraq on November 21, 2001, just 72 days after the September 11th attacks. The book also reveals that in July 2002, the White House secretly shifted $700 million that was allocated for the war in Afghanistan to begin preparations for the invasion of Iraq. The move may have been illegal because it was done so without the approval of Congress. Woodward's book also reports Secretary of State Colin Powell was purposely left out of the loop on much of the war planning because he had reservations about going into Iraq. According to the book, Saudi Arabia's ambassador to Washington, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, learned of Bush's war plans before Powell did. Beginning this week, the Supreme Court will hear three historic cases that will determine to what extent the president can detain U.S. citizens and foreigners without giving them any legal rights. The case will examine the U.S. detention of so-called enemy combatants in the U.S., as well as the detainees in Guantanamo Bay. In campaign news, Senator John Kerry accused President Bush of being, quote, stunningly ineffective in diplomacy. His comments came during an hour-long interview with Tim Russert on Meet the Press. Kerry said he would work to reestablish U.S. credibility around the world. Kerry also backed off statements he made 30 years ago on the same program when he admitted he'd committed atrocities in Vietnam and when he accused the U.S. military leadership in Vietnam of war crimes. On Sunday, Kerry said his comments from 71 were, quote, a little bit over the top. Also on Meet the Press, Kerry said he backed Israel's assassination of Hamas leader Abdelaziz Rantisi and said he supported President Bush's position on allowing Israel the right to keep settlements in Israel while rejecting the Palestinians' right of return to their homeland.
I know there's a better way. I know there's a different way. All that it takes is a new way of thinking. All that we need is to ask the right questions. It don't even matter if we have the solution. I'm so sick and tired of the way we are living. We don't have the time to think how we can change it. If you don't use your mind, there'll be nothing left to find.
Copper Women, broadcasting from the studio we are in San Francisco at Link TV and Berkeley at KPFA. Special thanks to KPFA's general manager, Jim Bennett, who is making this possible today. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel has sparked massive international outcry following its assassination this weekend of the new Hamas leader Abdelaziz al-Rantisi in Gaza. His car was hit by rockets fired from an Israeli military helicopter. The United Nations, the European Union, and several nations called the killing a clear violation of international law. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan labeled it an extrajudicial killing. Far from condemning the killing, the White House issued its standard statement calling for restraint on all sides. Meanwhile, Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry appeared on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday and appeared to support the assassination. In reaction to the news of Rantisi's killing, Kerry said, quote, I believe Israel has every right in the world to respond to any act of terror against it. Hamas is a terrorist, brutal organization. It has had years to make up its mind to take part in a peaceful process. They refuse to. Arafat refuses to, and I support Israel's efforts to try to separate itself and to try to be secure, unquote. Kerry also came out in support of President Bush's endorsement last week of Israel's plan to keep illegal settlements and Bush's assertion that Palestinian refugees should not be allowed the right of return. NBC's Tim Russert asked Kerry, do you support President Bush? Kerry said, yes. Russert asked, completely. Kerry said, yes. Bush made the statements in a news conference last week with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Meanwhile, in Gaza, tens of thousands of Palestinians marched through the streets in a funeral procession for Rantisi. Hamas says a new leader in Gaza has been appointed, but his identity is being kept secret for security reasons. The organization has vowed a, quote, volcano of revenge against Israel for the deaths, saying in a statement, revenge will come a hundredfold for the blood of Rantisi. And Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the Hamas spiritual leader who was assassinated by Israel last month. Meanwhile, in a statement on Israeli army radio, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon congratulated his army for the assassination, while another Israeli official said Israel also planned to kill another Hamas leader, Khaled Mashal, as soon as the opportunity arose. We are joined right now at KPFA's studios in Berkeley by Lamis Andoni. She is an independent journalist who's been covering the Middle East for 20 years. She's reported for the Christian Science Monitor, the Financial Times, as well as main newspapers in Jordan. She is currently teaching at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, I want to begin in the occupied territories in Gaza, your reaction to the assassination of the Hamas leader.
Yeah, it's typical of Israeli policies. It instead of facing the real problem, over the decades, it has either tried to expel Palestinian leaders or kill them. So it comes even at, it's ironic because it comes at the anniversary of the assassination of Abu Jihad in 1988 and the arrest of the very popular young leader Marwan Barghouti 2 years ago. I think the Israel is provoking a big confrontation and deliberately so. But it's not just the reaction will not just be against Israel, but against the U.S. Because combining this with what's happening in Iraq and with the Bush endorsement of Sharon's position and his also in the declaration, he implicitly endorsed the Israeli policy of fighting terrorism between courts and defending itself between courts. That gave the whole Arab world, not just the Palestinians, the understanding that it was a green light to Sharon, to Rantisi and others. So this is how it has been interpreted. And Sharon knows that by killing Rantisi, he would not stop violence, because if he wants to stop violence, he has to look at the actions of Israel and his own soldiers. I think that the U.S. is taking, is getting even more directly involved than ever. I've never seen in the Arab world before, although the U.S. is always have been held accountable for what's happening, but the U.S., especially with what's happening in Iraq and President Bush's declaration, it's the confrontation has never been as before between the U.S. and the Arab world because of Bush's actions. I mean, everybody used to say the U.S., and it's true, the U.S. sanctions Israel. This is different. Now, the U.S. has unequivocally disregarded any pretense, dropped any pretense for any appearance of moderation, to act as the direct colonizer of the Arab world, especially Palestine and Iraq.
What about those who have condemned the assassination as an extrajudicial killing, like Japan, like Britain, like Germany, like France?
Well, the difference between these countries and the U.S. is that the U.S. is carrying out its own extrajudicial killings. So, and the Israeli press has been making a point of it that Bush cannot criticize the killing of Hamas leaders or any Palestinian leader when they are doing exactly the same thing. So
where?
It's in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Yemen, and in Iraq. I mean, the way they're talking about Sadr, capture or killing him, this is extrajudicial. So the U.S. is leading the way now in extrajudicial, and Israel feels that it's been absolved from any responsibility, and I think that is alarming to all of the world. I mean, they're both acting above the rule of law, And I think other countries are very worried also of an explosion in the region. I mean, it's, and we're seeing signs of it. I mean, in Jordan, the government, the opposition is very strong. In Egypt is the same. I think either the U.S. is underestimating the feeling of solidarity from Iraq to Morocco to all of the Arab world, or it wants such an explosion to destabilize the whole region.
We're talking to Lama Sandoni. She is an independent journalist who's been covering the Middle East for 20 years. She teaches here at the UC, University of California Graduate School of Journalism at Berkeley. Lama Sandoni, I wanted to switch for a moment to Iraq and what is happening there. What's reported here in the United States is that this is the deadliest month for U.S. troops since 1971 and the Vietnam War. As for Iraqis who have been killed, we don't know the numbers. They're saying in Fallujah perhaps more than 650 Iraqis.
Yeah, I mean, and it's difficult still to know how many Iraqis have been killed, especially that the U.S. Has this policy of killing what it calls enemy targets, whether they are whether they are combatants or not. And the story of Fallujah has been underreported, as you know, in the press. However, what I want to emphasize here are two things. If there were any Iraqis that had any hopes or any illusions about the role of the U.S., this has been unmasked the last month. And I think more and more Iraqis are ready to join the resistance. And we've been seeing many indications that the more the killing continues and they hear what Bremer is saying and the threats, the more people are willing to join the resistance. In Fallujah, they accuse people, they claim that it's a hotbed for foreign fighters. This is nonsense. I want to remind the audience that even the Los Angeles Times in September, last September, Tracy Wilkinson did an investigation in Fallujah and she concluded that if there's resistance, it's homegrown. And there are more and more people in Fallujah who are like the sons and the husbands in Fallujah who are taking up arms. And I think people are connecting from the south of Iraq to the north of Iraq to join the resistance, and we're going to see more of that and more of attacks on American soldiers.
Lama Sandoni, on Friday, Muqtada Sadr gave a sermon from his stronghold in Al-Kufa, and he said he wouldn't disband the Mahdi army and called for the United States to leave.
Well, I think even though some Iraqis would like all of these militias to be disbanded, nobody would act upon the U.S. orders to disband a certain militia because because its leader defied the U.S. Occupation. I mean, what's happening here is that the American media, or most of it, as well as, of course, the American government, are trying to portray Sadr as this isolated person who has no support whatsoever, and that Ayatollah Sistani he has every interest in getting rid of Sadr. This is totally false, and it's a big lie, because the highest Shia authority led by Sistani in Najaf have made several statements that were that gone unreported in this country, that they oppose turning over Sadr, that if they have a problem with Sadr, it's between them, that the U.S., and that they condemned the occupation forces for what it did in Fallujah and warned against the storming of Najaf. So the American people are really being misled on the truth of how people feel about the attack on Sadr in Iraq. And if they capture or kill Sadr, the fears of the British commanders about Basra would be realized. And so far, that did not happen because Sistani believes that it was premature for such an uprising to start. He was afraid of bloodshed because of the firepower of the U.S., but not because he opposes an uprising.
Lamis Andoni, I want to thank you very much for being with us. She is an independent journalist who's been covering the Middle East for 20 years. She's reported for the Christian Science Monitor, the Financial Times, and the main newspapers in Jordan, currently teaching at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Davey D., to talk about hip-hop and surveillance. We will then hear from soldiers who have returned who are wounded, portrayed by youth radio here in the United States. As we continue our Exception to the Rulers tour, we are in Berkeley, headed to Santa Barbara tonight, and then to Los Angeles, a big event celebrating KPFK in Los Angeles on Wednesday night. This is Democracy Now!
Hold up the mirrors. A country built from bloodshed up and a crazy house of leers. The demon that you're staring at is closer than it appears.
The skies turn red, my heart is blanched, my chest shot through, the poison air is seeping in. My skin is only a screened window, my legs emanate the limbs, piled onto limbs and burials that no one should witness. My mouth keeps tipping, I scream from a mute galaxy and imagine the bombs falling like some sort of nightmare rain, even as we sit here holding hands in a place where rain is water and we can turn our faces up and smile taste. It has only been a few months since our own skies turned blood brown and smoke covered the smell of 5,000 dying, and our flags went up and our fists went down harder and harder until they were falling like rain on a land so far from our notions of reality that we can imagine our bombs looking like fireworks to a people we don't consider as such, dancing through the desert praying that the missile falling toward them will detonate, leaving only jars of peanut butter, white bread and jelly like they eat in America.
The ground is covered with apples, but you just kick the dirt. You don't see how beautiful, you don't see how perfect. I taste the fruit, yellow and crimson. I become part, I become one.
Copper Women, live in our studio here as we broadcast Democracy Now! From San Francisco, singing Mirrors. They're from Sonoma County in California, and a shout-out to our friends at KRCB and KPFA here in California. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our Exception to the Rulers tour with community journalists highlighting them around the country. Since the Bush administration took office over three years ago, the number of secret surveillance warrants sought by the FBI has increased some 85%. This is one of the findings of the commission investigating the 9/11 attacks. Over the past few weeks, there have been a number of stories in the press about surveillance against hip-hop artists. Recently, the New York Police Department hosted a hip-hop training seminar attended by several law enforcement agencies. At the meeting, a 6-inch-thick black binder was handed out. It included the arrest records and photos of dozens of rap artists and their companions. Also, the Village Voice newspaper recently revealed the existence of a hip-hop intelligence unit within the New York Police Department. With us right now to talk about these issues, as well as hip-hop culture and the elections, we're joined by Davey D. He is a hip-hop journalist, DJ, community activist. He's the webmaster for what's considered one of the oldest and largest hip-hop sites on the web, Davey D's Hip-Hop Corner, which can be found at www.davyd.com. Also is a community broadcaster here in the Bay Area. He does Hard Knock Radio every afternoon at 4, Monday through Friday, when he can. It's on KPFA. Davey D is our community broadcaster today.
Thank
Welcome.
You. Thank you for having me. You also forget I'm a vicious opponent to George Bush.
add that to my resume.
Well, maybe this first subject has something to do with it. Can you talk about surveillance?
Well, I think right now there's a lot of interest because you're hearing the headlines, as you mentioned, that hip-hop artists are being put under surveillance. And I think when we look at that, if we take it out of its historical and political context, we're left with the impression that the surveillance just happened. And the reason that it's being triggered is because something is wrong with hip-hop culture and the people involved with it. So therefore, we need to keep close tabs on everybody from P. Diddy Combs to Jay-Z and whoever, and make sure that their entourages, because the police are always saying it's not the artists, it's their entourages, aren't causing any crime, you know, in the areas that they happen to be at. The thing is, the truth of the matter is that the surveillance of black men in particular have been taking place for generations. And this surveillance of hip-hop artists is just a new name for the war on drugs. It's a new name for COINTELPRO, meaning that there's always been these excuses to somehow have law enforcement come into the community and keep tabs. So that's one thing. Now, if we're surveilling hip-hop artists, the question comes, you have to ask, is how much crime, because the reason why you're surveilling these artists is there must be some sort of crime laws that they're breaking. So how much crime is taking place in hip-hop in relationship to crime in general? You know, is P. Diddy or Jay-Z, are they running drug cartels? If you surveil them and you somehow are able to take them off the scene, will drugs in the community stop? If you're able to surveil them, will shootings and gun trafficking stop? And that's not really the case. Even if you're able to point and say, well, over the past couple of years, 30 or 40 rap artists have been arrested, how does that stack up in comparison with just crime in general? And I would think that you would find, well, that's a very small blip on the radar. So what's really going on? I think that what is happening is that the artists are being used, this pretext of surveilling artists is being used to set up a situation where you can really start coming into communities where there's a lot of activism going on. Why we talk about in these headlines that rap artists who have troubled past are being surveilled, what they're not telling you is that Van Jones, who was right here on the show earlier, was surveilled. You see what I'm saying? What they're not telling you is that Michael Frani, who's gone around the country doing anti-war songs and peace work, and every album that he's put out has centered around a theme for peace and justice issues, has been surveilled. You know, meaning that law enforcement has showed up and had pictures and dossiers and the whole thing. I think right here on Democracy Now! You broke that story. So that's one of the things that we really have to look at. The other thing is that if you're surveilling these rap artists, and the rap artists are connected to the music industry, and we know that the music industry has a long and seedy past and shady past, and that there's always been a lot of flirtation, at the very least, between legitimate business and an underworld business, has that stopped? Payola still exists in the music business. And in fact, last year...
Explain what you mean by payola.
Payola meaning that a lot of the records that you hear on commercial radio are bought and paid for. Now, there's ways in which it's masked. You might see a radio station van. You might see artists doing free concerts. You might see a convention taking place in a tropical place like Jamaica or Hawaii where everybody was flown to it. You might have a listening party, but payola takes place. And in fact, last year, there was an incident involving, I think, Hot 97 DJ in New York, Funkmaster Flex, and this whole thing of payola came up. And there was talk that they were going to do this big investigation at the Senate and Congress and all these people that are now allowing the police to surveil rap artists. We're going to do this investigation on payola, which means that if you really start to dig deep, it's going to be much more than the P. Diddy's and Jay-Z's. There's going to be some suit and tie type cats who are pulling a lot of weight in the music industry who are going to be going down. Suddenly that was off the radar, disappeared. I know that there were going to be magazines and newspapers doing big stories on it. Those stories got killed. Yet we still have the police surveilling rap artists. The other thing we have to look at, that with all this surveillance going on, they still haven't been able to find the killers for Notorious B.I.G. They haven't been able to find the killers for Tupac, haven't been able to find the killers for Jam Master Jay, and the list goes on. So with all this surveillance going on, how is it that you can have law enforcement show up
at the homes and places of work of activists like Van Jones or Michael Frani and say, look, we've been following their travels. We know everything they did. We listened to their lyrics, yada, yada, yada. But you can't find the killers of some of the most prominent artists who have been slain dead. Yet and still, we are able to find, here in San Francisco, for example, a police officer was killed the other day. Suddenly, they were able to find, you know, somebody to that they want to hold accountable for that, like within a day or so. You have a woman that was in Concord, which is a suburb out of San Francisco, who was murdered maybe about a year ago with no witnesses. You know, 6 months later, they find a killer. You know, because DNA testing, they did all this technological, you know, they brought all this technology into play and were able to solve the crime. Yet you can have hundreds of people on the strip in Las Vegas when Tupac was shot, and we still can't find a killer.
Why do you think they haven't found the killers of Notorious B.I.G. and Tupac?
Well, I think there's a few things that come into play. I think, one, that they're not really serious about it. And I think the other thing is that a lot of times with law enforcement, there's funding that goes on if you are undertaking certain types of activities. So meaning that you might have divisions in the police department that will apply for a grant, get a certain amount of money under the auspices of enforcing, like in San Francisco, maybe a smoking regulation. So that's what they get paid to do. And maybe, and I'm not a law enforcement person, but maybe that is one of the guises in which people are able to justify their jobs. We have to surveil these rap artists. They're the ones that are causing the problems. Maybe it's a public relations spin, that if we keep tabs on these guys who have these controversial and pro-violent type lyrics, if we surveil them, then the public is feeling, okay, the police are doing a good job, versus really looking at the entire picture and saying, for example, why aren't we surveilling the executives that give safe haven and actually promote and market some of these songs that people are concerned about.
What do you think of the theory that it's an east-west clash between rivals, Biggie and Tupac, and each side killed the other?
Right, the east-west clash that they had when the Panthers were around, right? The east-west clash that they had for many generations, meaning that people from different geographical areas are going to always have the potential for clash. There's a clash between the Celtics and the Lakers, you know what I'm saying? So there's always going to be that. With the situation when the Raps scenario, first of all, I think that was overblown. But if you really wanted to get deep into it, let's get deep into it. It wasn't just Biggie versus Tupac. One of the things that triggered any sort of tension between the coasts, meaning New York and L.A., was the fact that New York was a major marketplace where radio stations would not play music from those outside forces. That was the seed that really spawned that. So if we really want to investigate that, maybe we need to get a Tracy Clardy, who was the PD of Hot 97. Maybe we need to talk to whoever was running MTV and some of these other places and go, well, if this is a problem, why aren't you giving, you know, this access to people? Because after all, if you're not, it's causing some sort of tension. I mean, if the name of the game is to prevent a scenario that could lead to violence, but that wasn't really the case, you know.
We're talking to hip-hop journalist Davey D, and we're going to be back with him here on Democracy Now!, broadcasting from San Francisco in a minute.
Music hitting your heart, cause I know you got soul.
Hey,
listen, if you're missing y'all, swinging while I'm singing.
Hey,
giving what you're getting, knowing what I'm knowing, while the black band's sweating in the rhythm I'm rolling. Gotta give us what we want, gotta give us what we need.
Hey,
our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power.
That's
the rhythm designed to bounce with calcium, that's the
rhyme
designed to fill your mind. Now that you realize the prize arrives,
we
got to pump the
stuff
to make it tough. From the heart, it's a start, a work of art to revolutionize, make a change, something strange.
People, people,
we are the same. No, we're not the same, cause we don't know the game. What we need is awareness. We can't get careless.
You
say
This is Democracy Now! And democracynow.org. We are broadcasting out of San Francisco on our 70-city Exception to the Rulers tour, highlighting community radio and television stations around the country. Independent media in a time of war. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined by a community broadcaster, a hip-hop journalist, Davey D., who does Hard Knock Radio on KPFA, the First Pacifica station. It is based in the Bay Area, based in Berkeley, California. We're talking about a number of issues, including surveillance of the hip-hop community. Davey D. is also one of the co-authors of How to Get Stupid White Men Out of Office, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But, Davey D., can you talk more about the issue of surveillance?
Well, there's a couple of things, as I said, that if you're surveilling rap artists, and rap artists are connected to the music industry, then where's the surveillance going on in other aspects of the music industry where you know drugs are rampant, where you know extortion, pay-to-play is rampant? And in fact, some people tell you that the reason why they have these large entourages is for protection against some of these things. So it's not just a rap thing. It's a whole industry thing if you really want to get down to it. And again, I'm saying that the surveillance is taking place under the pretext of other activities that have always allowed law enforcement to come into our communities and surveil black men in particular, you know, the war on drugs, COINTELPRO. The other thing, let's go back, when really the surveillance really started to happen in hip-hop was when you started to have a politicizing of the rap artists. When Public Enemies did a video and had a senator, you know, car blown up after they did what, by the time I get to Arizona, you know, meaning they were making a political statement because Arizona wouldn't allow the passage of the Martin Luther King holiday. When NWA did the song F the Police, and all of a sudden they got a letter from the FBI. That put the group under surveillance. When you had rap artists in the Bay Area like Mac Dre, who was one of the first artists that was surveilled and then brought into court and convicted based upon rap lyrics and what have you. Here's a guy who in the Vallejo, which is north of San Francisco, was responding to a rash of bank robberies that were taking place in which the police started to target people in the Crestside neighborhood that he lived in. He wrote a song called Punk Police and actually called out one of the sergeants of the police force. That triggered him to be surveilled. And so as he was making a trip down to Fresno, he was followed by the local law enforcement as well as the FBI. This was about 10, 12 years ago, and eventually convicted under the conspiracy to rob a bank because the partner that he was with said he was planning to rob a bank. He wasn't caught with no weapons. He didn't rob a bank, but this conspiracy law came into play. There was a group out of Redwood City, which is south of San Francisco, that came under fire when they started to talk about the police. And so one of the results is that in Oakland, for example, they have a book, just like they do in New York, on rap artists. This book has been out and is on its third printing. It's been out for at least 7 years that I know of, and it was written by a sergeant in Utah, a very detailed book. The Summer Jam concerts that take place right here in the Bay Area, you have to go through the Redwood City Police in order for them to approve who gets to go on the stage or not go on the stage if they're rap artists, not rock and roll artists, if they're rap artists right here in Mountain View. So the point that I'm getting at is that these activities have been going on for a long time, and it's something that is that has to be looked at from a historical, political, and social context. And lastly, just for the rap artists, from talking with people in law enforcement when I was trying to get a hold of this book, which I still can't get a hold but did see, one of the things I was told is that a lot of times the officers, you know, in the course of just doing their surveillance, they listen very intently to the lyrics, and they study the albums of these people. This is what is putting Lil' Kim under the crosshairs now, because in one statement she says, I don't know the people that were involved with the shooting that took place 2 years ago. And then they're looking at her album cover and seeing that she thanked one of the people that she said she didn't know. And so law enforcement has been doing that, combing some of these rap lyrics and saying, hey, 2 years ago, somebody in your entourage said that they don't know you, but you mentioned them in a song. So these are the things that are going on, but it's not happening in a vacuum.
We're talking to Davey D. What about the recent arrest of the New York-based hip-hop group Dead Prez? That song, Know Your Enemy, one of the lyrics is, George Bush is way worse than Bin Laden is.
Well, I mean, Dead Prez, obviously a politicized group, probably under surveillance for a long time, and I'm sure that law enforcement would always be trying to find an excuse to go after them. And I agree with M1. And M1, I think, said recently in an interview, if this is happening, the community needs to find a way to counteract that and needs to find a way to protect themselves, because obviously all the surveillance isn't protecting all the folks who they say need to be protected. You know, crimes are unsolved. Crime is, you know, there's all the stuff that's still going on in the music industry. And more importantly, as I said at the beginning of the show, if you got rid of all these artists, if they disappeared tomorrow and you locked them up behind bars, gun trafficking, drug trafficking, prostitution, all these ills that we say that are the justification for surveilling rap artists would still be in existence, except it would be done by the Gottis, the John Gottis of the world, who are part of the music industry, but from what I can tell, are not under surveillance.
And there's Boots Riley of the Coup.
Boots Riley, yeah. But, you know, also going back, as Michael Franti would point out, Bob Marley was being surveilled once upon a time, as well as a lot of artists in his generations in the 70s. And that was under the guise of COINTELPRO, where there was this concern that subversive action was taking place in the cultural arts community. You know, when people were doing the spoken word poems and they were talking about, you know, opposing war and all these other things, that maybe they were somehow connected at that time to communist and outside entities that would lead to the destruction of the country.
Davey D., you're one of the co-authors of the book, How to Get Stupid White Men Out of Office. You've got some advice for the Democratic Party.
No. The main thing that I wrote about, Nair, was the fact that they have not taken very seriously large segments of the population. They take for granted people of color, young people, and as a result, they do not do their homework. In other words, if a Democratic candidate is running and they want to get the elderly, they have somebody find out the issues. They become aware of the hangouts, the places, the things of interest, their key trigger issues. But if you ask that same staff person and that same candidate, well, tell me about the folks in East Oakland or in the Harlem or Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, they couldn't tell you what radio station they listen to, what magazines they read, and where they go. The result is that you don't have any sort of serious commitment to establish a meaningful dialogue and relationship with the segments of the population, which at the end results in issues not being addressed and a lot of assumptions being made when they give speeches. And my advice was really to take very seriously the lifestyle of the people that they're trying to reach, learn about it, and start to establish dialogue. And I gave a number of examples that...
Give them.
Well, for one, if I was running for any sort of office, I'd be at a Raider game. 60,000 people at a football game, I'd be walking around buying everybody beers. People may say, well, why that? Because people would talk about it. Wow, you were running for governor, and you came to my football game wearing my jersey and shook hands and kissed babies and did the networking that was necessary, and also gave people a reason to talk about you. If there are nightclubs where most people go, how many candidates go to a nightclub and really try to build with the people that are there? Most of the people who go are 21 and older, their voting age. Do you know the programs that they listen to? Do you know the radio stations that they most likely, you know, are going to engage in? Do you have a relationship with the producers of those radio shows so that if you even want to talk to them, that you can, you know, have access? Are you fighting behind the scenes to make sure that on a popular station that they don't have their public affairs show at 6 in the morning, but maybe at 9 or 10 when most people are listening, where you may have a platform to reach the folks that you want to talk to. So the point being is that it seems like because there's this lack of attention and lack of activity to really try to engage folks in these communities, that it comes down to me believing that it's in the vested interest of a lot of people, including these Democrats, to not really bring as many people under the fold as possible. Maybe it's because they feel that they don't want to be accountable to a large number of people, so it's easier to keep people disinterested and bored and not involved so that they can just focus on a small group.
David, would you consider running for public office?
Never run for public office.
Why?
It's not my thing. I think it's a certain type of individual that needs to do it, and I wouldn't run to that because I'm not willing to engage myself in that. That's just me personally, but I mean, I'm certainly would support people.
Are people voting in the whole hip-hop community? Is it a thing to do this year?
That's the big debate going on. On one end, you have people that say it's not going to make a difference, and why feed into a system that systematically is destroying you and everything that you believe in? And then the other side is that, you know, we participate in the system in some way, shape, or form. We all pay taxes. We pull over when the police flash their sirens. So we are dealing with some of the realities of this system. So at least, at the very least, let's look at voting as a weapon and use it to our advantage. As Tupac was saying before he died, he said, you know, maybe a couple of months before he died, so I'm going to take my 6 million fans and make them become a force that holds some of these elected officials accountable. Here they're going to upset, you know, the situation, upset the apple cart. And so to me, voting is one of many weapons that you can choose. You can pick up a rifle, you can do civil disobedience, and at the same time, you can do voting, especially since it's not costing me any money. And it will, at the very least, force somebody who is trying to get into these seats of power, to have to run a few extra yards, expend a few extra resources, and maybe even address some of my issues. And at the same time, we should be grooming people who really do want to run for office and get behind them as well.
Is there an anti-Bush sentiment in the hip-hop community?
Definitely. Yeah, to the point that there's been 4 anti-war compilation albums that have been put out by hip-hoppers, which you don't hear being played on radio.
Who?
Oh, gosh. There's one that came out of the Bay Area, you know, out of the Ella Baker Center and Freedom Fighter Records. There's one that Hard Knock Radio, Hard Knock Records put out. There's one that came from overseas, and then there's another one from the Bay Area called War that was put out by my man Billy Jam. And these are compilation albums. That's 4. You also have a compilation song that came out with a lot of L.A.'s quote-unquote gangster rappers, Superfly, RBX, Defari, Dub C, who's with the West Side Connection. They did an anti-war song at the start of the war. But radio stations, commercial stations in Los Angeles refused to play the record. But as Dub C pointed out, you can turn on the radio right now and hear his song Gangsta Nation being played. You can turn on the song on any radio station in L.A. and hear any of those artists that were featured on that song, Down With Us, being played when they're talking about partying, when they're talking about street life and all these other things. But when they made a political statement and all came together, Radio 1, Emma's Broadcasting, Clear Channel refused to play the record. And let me just add that those guys are back in the studio getting ready to do a part 2 against Bush. I think it's going to be called Bye Bye Bye. And they're bringing a whole posse of West Coast rappers to really put out a message. So there's definitely an anti-Bush sentiment in hip-hop right now.
National Hip-Hop Convention that's going to take place in New Jersey this summer. When is it? And is that time for the conventions and the election?
That's going to be June 16th to the 19th. That's going to be in Newark, New Jersey. And that's that very often underreported, behind-the-scenes effort that has really been galvanizing a lot of people. There's been organizing, local organizing committees in more than 30 cities around the United States. Very proficient organizers that are at the helms of many of these local organizing committees who are gaining a lot of ground. And it's being patterned after the 1972 Gary Convention, where black folks came together and really set an agenda. And that is trying to be replicated on a hip-hop front. And I think one of the highlights of this convention will be a passing of the torch, because it's going to be an entire day spent with dealing with the generation gap, meaning like a lot of those folks who came out of the black power and black struggle movements of the 60s and 70s will be on hand to really deal with some of the issues that we're faced with today, many of which are the same thing, including surveillance of popular figures.
And how are you going to deal with the fact that there will be agents there?
Well, I think, you know, to quote Dave Hilliard, you know, who is former chief of staff of the Black Panther Party, you first of all just got to keep doing what you're doing. You know that that's happening. And I think that has to be underscored by your commitment to really communicate and get the issues before the folks that are in front of you. For me, for example, I just don't send an email out. I will call people and make sure they get the email. One-on-one communication, constant communication with folks, so that if we focus everybody up on particular issues and principles for us to rally around, which I think is the main goal of the conveners of the convention, Ross Baraka, Rosa Clemente, and all those folks, what will happen is that when people start to go astray, you'll be able to look at something and say, well, wait a second, Amy, you're, You know, we talked about being against police surveillance. You seem to be supporting that. Let's maybe examine this a little bit more as opposed to just sitting back and being blindsided. There's not much you can do, initially about the police surveillance. It's going to be up to us to make sure that people who are in these positions of power and influence are held accountable, meaning like we need to make sure the mayor of Oakland doesn't have police surveillance going on in his police department of rap artists. And we need to do that on a national level as well, make that become a front and center issue that will either get you unelected or elected, depending on the position you take.
David D., I want to thank you very much for being with us and for doing the work that you do.
Thank you.
Thanks for your book, How to Get Stupid White Men out of office. And if people want to hit your website, or if there's trouble with that, your email, give it to us.
Yeah, my website is davyd.com, and my email is mrdavyd@AOL. That's mrdavyd@AOL.com.
Thanks.
Thank you, Amy.
This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to focus on another community radio group, and that is youth radio in the Bay Area. As many as 11,700 U.S. soldiers have been wounded in Iraq since President Bush ordered the invasion. All of the injured GIs returning to the United States go through Andrews Air Force Base in suburban Maryland. Since Andrews is the first stop home, it's where soldiers start the process of healing and reflecting on what it means to be injured and a war veteran. Youth Radio produced this audio postcard of some young soldiers and the nurses taking care of them.
This is the area where we on and offload patients 3 days out of the week, generally speaking, from Germany. The buses go out, pick them up, and then they offload them here. So we can go right in here.
We work in the tennis court area. It's a huge tennis court that we broke down. We have 50 beds in it. We take care of our patients here. We do their vital signs, dressing changes, anything that we need to keep them stable and healthy.
It's just interesting what we see, like when we first rolled into the country. Kuwait was, you know, it was desert, but I mean it was a bit nicer. And as soon as we rolled into Iraq, you could see how bad the country actually was.
Explosions such as grenades or landmines are common. They'll have maybe a broken leg, maybe a gunshot wounds, shrapnel wounds from an explosion.
The thing I remember most is seeing an Iraqi man in a Baghdad hospital who was the victim of an improvised explosive device, which can be boxes, dolls, car tires. From what I was told, he lost his sight, a lot of physical damage to his face. Since he has to live through that the rest of his life, I think he's probably got it worse than a lot of people do. Me seeing that kind of, and leaving that country made me feel guilty.
I just got off the phone with like my best friend back home. I don't know, from him calling me an idiot and all this other stuff, just for joining the Army, because he didn't want me to join. With my injuries, I may not be in the Army very much longer. I'm going to be a 21-year-old freshman in college. And a war vet at that, with a Purple Heart.
You can see the change from troops that go over there, before they've gone over there, and when they come back. Instead of being as flighty, I guess, in a matter of speaking, they're less worried about video games and stuff like that, and they're more worried about, like, the politics and stuff, which most young people, on an average, probably aren't.
There's a lot more people over there getting hurt. I mean, people are, getting hurt all around you, getting shot, getting blown up. From what they're saying here, it was over. There wasn't anything going on. It was, we had already started making peace.
And it wasn't so?
No. Not by any case. I don't feel that way anyways.
I've met some patients that have turned 18 over there in Iraq. It's very sad to me. Honestly, it's hurtful to see them come back hurt in that condition, whether they got it from an accident or they were actually fighting for their lives. I love being here, being able to help these soldiers out, so I just do the best I can they do the best they can.
You know, I just turned 21. Now, I've done more in my life between the ages of 17 and 21 than most people will do in their whole life. It makes you just feel old because you've done so much in your life. Mm-hmm. And then you look and you see how much of your life you still have left.
Reflections on Return from the War in Iraq, produced by Youth Radio based in D.C., The voices you've been listening to include U.S. Army Specialist Layman Frank and Collins, Senior Airman Woodyard, and Lieutenant Colonel Hayward. Special thanks to Youth Radio reporter Enrique Rivera. Joining us in the studio is Ursula Mel, who is a producer with Youth Radio here in the Bay Area. Can you tell us about Youth Radio?
Yeah. Youth Radio is based in Berkeley, and basically it's a training program for 14 to 17 year olds, and we train youth in broadcasting skills. We give them broadcasting skills, engineering skills, DJing skills, journalism. It's really an amazing program.
Well, this is a remarkable piece.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely one of the best pieces to come out of Youth Radio. And basically the way Youth Radio works is students will sign up and then they will go through the classes, and once they are through the classes, then they can intern at Youth Radio and do any number of things, everything from we have community outreach programs to working in the newsroom. We have a fully operational newsroom, to actually helping to peer teach the classes and teach the new students.
And where do you broadcast your pieces?
We broadcast our pieces all over the place. We broadcast them on KPFA. We actually have an hour-long show every Saturday morning on KPFA. But we give pieces to KCBS, and we've broadcast pieces on KISS.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Ursula Mel, producer with Youth Radio. And that does it for today's program. Again tonight, looking forward to seeing folks in Santa Barbara tonight at 7 p.m. at University of California Santa Barbara's Campbell Hall for Benefit Community Radio Station KCSB. On Wednesday, we'll be celebrating KPFK at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, 3300 Wilshire Boulevard at 7 p.m., a reception before. Call KPFK to find out more details. And you can go to our website for our Exception to the Rulers book and media tour. We're going to 70 cities celebrating community media, democracynow.org/book. And that does it for today's program. We want to especially thank here in San Francisco, well, the whole staff of KPFA, and special thanks to Mark Erickson and the crew here at Media One Studio in San Francisco, Kim Spencer and Heather Herford of Link TV, our longtime partners broadcasting Democracy Now! Over Dish Network, and that is Free Speech TV, channel 9415, and a very special thanks to Uri Galed, our director and the producers of Democracy Now!, Sharif Abdel-Kaddous, Mike Burke, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo here as well, and all of the volunteers who've helped make this program possible. Special also thank you to Chuck Skurich and Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!